Good morning, friends, and welcome back to Midpoint. My first priority today is to extend my very sincere thanks to all of our Midpoint listeners who stepped up and donated to support WMNF in our spring fund drive that just ended this morning. We are so grateful that you are a part of this beloved community that has a mission to provide a platform for diverse voices, all committed to a more just, peaceful, and sustainable world. So thank you. Thank you truly. Now that the pledge drive is over, we are closing out Black History Month with a look at a very important episode in Tampa's history that is little known but very significant. The play, When the Righteous Triumph, and now the documentary film produced by Tampa's PBS channel, WEDU, tells a powerful, untold story of 1960s Tampa, where a courageous group of Black students from Middleton and Blake High Schools, led by Clarence Fort, then the president of the local NAACP Youth Council, organized peaceful sit-ins at the Woolworth lunch counter in February 1960. That sparked the integration of all lunch counters, theaters, pools, and beaches across this region, without the violence that plagued other cities in the South. So today, right after our news nugget of the week, we are going to be talking about this important history with my guests, the playwright Mark E. Lieb, who dramatized the story of the Tampa sit-ins in the play, When the Righteous Triumph, and with Arthenia Joyner, a local legendary activist and now a lawyer, who was one of the high school students who participated in the sit-ins. And joining us by telephone is former Congressman Jim Davis, who is the grandson of then Tampa civic leader and lawyer Cody Fowler, who was a supporter of desegregation and who helped to persuade the city's elites and business leaders to peacefully desegregate. Jim Davis was also instrumental in bringing this play and the history it was based on to a wider audience in Tampa. Now, the WEDU documentary is available for viewing on demand through the PBS app or pbs.org. But first, let's talk about what is happening around Florida and in the legislature right now. As always, the opinions expressed on the show are mine alone and do not necessarily represent those of WMNF, the Nathan B. Stubblefield Foundation, which holds our FCC license, or my guests on the show today. You've all heard me say many times that the Florida legislative season is the most dangerous season of all in Florida, because for the last quarter century, that is when our Republican-controlled legislature has made life for Floridians even less affordable, less safe, and less free. And now they're trying to do it again. The 2026 legislature is now quietly moving forward with legislation that would make Floridians the target of government surveillance and potential arrest. House Bill 945, sponsored by Representative Danny Alvarez of Riverview, and Senate Bill 1712, sponsored by Senator Jonathan Martin of Fort Myers, would greenlight the creation of a new counterintelligence and counterterrorism unit within the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. This unit's primary mission would include the detection, identification, and neutralization of, I'm quoting now, adversary intelligence entities, which include any person whose demonstrated actions, views, or opinions are a threat or are inimical to the interests of this state and the United States of America. Well, listeners, the interest of those in control of this state seem to be engaging in as much corruption and graft as possible. Those are the interests I see. I don't know about you, but I'm against that. I guess you can just put me on the bus to the gulag now, because if this plainly unconstitutional law exists, a law that makes opinions equivalent to terrorism, I'm afraid I violate it every week on Midpoint. Listen, this kind of law is modeled after the Stasi in East Germany, Putin's KGB, the Gestapo in Hitler's Germany. We are deep in 1984 territory with a law like this. These Tallahassee legislators know it is unconstitutional, but they don't care. They don't care that they'll be sued the first time they ever try to enforce it, because it just means that they can divert more, even more, of our taxpaying dollars to their favored Republican law firms to defend it. Money that then comes back to the legislators in campaign contributions. Please, please pay attention to what is happening in Tallahassee while you still can. The session is scheduled to end in just 2 weeks. There's still time to make an impact by sharing your opinions with your legislators. Do it before it becomes a crime. All right, let's get on to our topic of the day with my extraordinary guests who are here to talk about a pivotal moment in Tampa's history, and I dare say the history of the civil rights movement. It came to be called the Tampa Technique. It was a civil rights strategy that focused on peaceful, negotiation-based desegregation to integrate public spaces in Tampa, like lunch counters, theaters, and other city business spaces. It involved collaboration between black student leaders and white business leaders to successfully achieve desegregation without violence and often with police protection. It was fairly unique in the South, where the civil rights struggle was so often confronted by violent resistance from the white community. The Tampa Technique was actually turned into a play by my guest Mark E. Lieb, a playwright, theater critic, and professor of fiction, playwriting, and screenwriting at the University of South Florida. And Mark Lieb is here with us today. So welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
The play is called When the Righteous Triumph, and it tells the story of the first student lunch counter sit-in in Tampa. One of those students is with us today to talk about that experience. Arthenia Joyner is a graduate of Middleton High School, and she was among the students who participated in that sit-in in 1960. She is an attorney and civil rights activist who served as a member of the Florida Senate for 10 years, from 2006 to 2016, and she ended her political career as minority leader in the state Senate. Arthenia Joyner is with us today in the studio, and we welcome her.
I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you, Arthenia. And Jim Davis is with us on the telephone. Jim is a former United States congressman and the grandson of Cody Fowler, who was a civic leader in Tampa in 1960. And he was a leader of the business community in Tampa who supported desegregation. Cody Fowler was instrumental in influencing the mayor and city leaders to negotiate with the students and with the police to bring desegregation to Tampa without violence. Recently, Jim was instrumental in bringing the play to a wider audience in Tampa, so this important history was forgotten. I'm happy to have Jim Davis with us on the telephone. Are you on the air, Jim?
I'm on the air if you say so.
Okay, there you are. Great. I'm glad you were able to join us. All right, let's talk about When the Righteous Triumph and the Tampa Technique. Let me start with you, Mark. What inspired you to write this play, When the Righteous Triumph, and to focus the play on the Tampa 1960 sit-ins that led to desegregation locally?
Well, that goes back to 2021.
Okay.
I had written about 20 full-length plays by that time, and I was looking around for a subject for something new. Meanwhile, I've been an avid student of the Hebrew Bible for most of my adult life, and I've been much impressed by God's call for social justice in the Torah, in the prophets, and in the Psalms. So I decided that I wanted to write a play on a social justice theme. My wife, meanwhile, had been urging me for a while to write about Tampa. I had spent almost 20 years in New England, though I was born and raised in Tampa, and so many of my plays were about the Northeast. So I decided maybe she has something that I should be paying attention to. And I found a history of Tampa by Andrew T. Hughes called From Saloons to Steakhouses. As I read through it, I found a chapter called A Place at the Table, which was all about the sit-ins in 1960 that desegregated downtown Tampa lunch counters. I was stunned because I grew up in Tampa. I went to elementary school, junior high, and high school in Tampa, and I didn't know a thing about these sit-ins. I learned that in 1960, if you were an African-American, you weren't allowed at Larry Park Zoo and movie theaters and pools and public beaches. It was pretty shocking. So I did some more research, and I could imagine a stage in which the lunch counter was right at the center, and everything took place around a lunch counter. I went to Carla Hartley over at StageWorks. StageWorks is in the Channelside District of Tampa.
Yeah, the theater.
Mm-hmm. The theater, yes. And I'd worked with Carla several times in the past.
She's the producing director there, right?
She is the producing director. She runs StageWorks.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her my idea for the play. And I said, Carla, I'd like you to commission this from me. She thought for about 3 minutes, and she said, I'll do it. So we came up with a system which would have me writing the play in 21, StageWorks workshopping the play with staged readings and table readings and in 22, and then a premiere in 2023. That's exactly what happened. I had the help of various people, including the actors and the director, Chris Jackson. And by 2023, I had a finished product, and it was produced at StageWorks. And
saw it at StageWorks.
Oh, did you really?
Yes, I saw it when it was at StageWorks. It was a terrific production, really great. The acting was fabulous.
Yes, the acting and directing were amazing.
Yeah, it was good. So that would have been 2023 then, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So we ran for a few weekends at StageWorks, and then someone introduced me to Jim Davis. And Jim, whom I had not known until that time, said, Mark, I love the play. I think it needs a bigger audience. I'd like to take it to the Straz. I said, that's a great idea, but it's going to take a lot of money to open at the Straz, because even by opening night, one has to spend a couple $100,000 to get a play running.
Wow.
Jim said, don't worry about it. I can raise the money. And he did.
Let me ask him about that. Jim, what led you to want to bring the play to the Straz, and how hard or easy was it to raise the money to do so?
You know, Michelle, this story that has been masterfully captured by Chris Jackson and Carla Hartley in StageWorks is a very compelling example of how we work together in turbulent times. And since Mark started, it's become even more timely and necessary to hold up as an example, not just for our community, not just for the state of Florida, for the whole country. And so that has propelled me from the beginning and every day, and it led to a lot of people across the political spectrum. And this is a very important point. This play appeals to folks all over the political spectrum to support this, particularly showing and telling this story about our history, not Black history, not white or brown history, American history, to students. And so we have raised about $600,000. I just want to tell you that the schools want to send over 10,000 students to see the play, particularly the local Catholic schools. And so there's been a groundswell of support for this, and now we're starting to experience that nationally.
Well, where did the money come from? I mean, I'm not asking for names, but in general, like, where did you find the support to bring the play to a wider audience?
A lot of individuals.
Okay.
And this information's public, so I'll give you a name, for example, Frank Morsani, who's a wonderful philanthropist in our community. And really,
and for whom the major theater at the Straz is named, right?
Right. A lot of the names on all the theaters at the Straz are supporters of this. And some of the people who lived in Tampa forever that remember the 60s and stood up and did the right thing then, and their parents and grandparents are gone, but they want that story told. So a very broad cross-section of the community, and people from the faith community, retired judges and teachers. Arthenia Mark and I, with Julian Lane, the grandson of the mayor, Shirley Lowry, the widow of Reverend Lowry. We have had an army of folks supporting this. And again, now folks around the country working with us.
Wow. Arthenia, when you found out about this play and that it was being produced, what kind of feelings did it create in you? Did it take you back to those days of being a 17-year-old in Tampa in 1960? What was that like for you?
It was heartwarming to know that Mark had written this play and that it was being produced. So I was anxious to go to stage work. And I was there the premiere night.
Of course.
As you were. And it was wonderful.
Yeah. Did it take you back to that time? Do you feel like it really spoke to that time in a way that you could really recognize as having been there yourself?
Yes. It was very vivid in the scenes at the lunch counter that we endured, faced that particular day, February 29th, 1960.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, of course,
this week in 1960, right?
Yes, this week. That's right. It was a real flashback in time, and it just started me to thinking about how far we have come and that we still have miles to go.
Yeah. Well, you know, before you engaged in this activity back in 1960, when you were a high school student, there had been lunch counter sit-ins in North Carolina before the Tampa sit-ins, and those were violent. Those students were really, treated very badly. They were attacked, that's what you had to have known about when you and Clarence Fort and all of the others who participated in the sit-ins in Tampa, you had to know about all that. So, one thing that I wonder is, were you scared? Were you scared in going into this? Did you feel fear? And if you did, how did you manage it?
We knew about it because the first sit-in, North Carolina, was February 1st of 1960. So here we are 28 days later deciding. Now, Clarence Fort, a local barber, young man, president of the NAACP Youth Council, really was the genius behind the sit-in. He went to the presidents of Middleton and Blake student body, George Edgecombe at Middleton and Shafter Scott at Blake, and said, I need 20 students. And he explained what it was that he wanted to do. So the presidents contacted several of us and asked, and of course, some said yes, and others, parents told them no for fear that they would be fired or whatever. But when I told my folks, my dad said, I don't think you should do that, because he was older than my mom, 20 years older. So he had lived through terrible Jim Crow in the 30s and 40s, 50s, 60s. My mom said, do what your conscience dictates.
Really?
And we'll support you. So, and I was going to do it anyway. As Carmen Guignon said, some of us were told no, but we went anyway. But we knew that there could possibly be violence. We met at St. Paul AME Church, and we were instructed, we got instructions, and we were told that if someone attacks you, you have to turn the other cheek. This is going to be a nonviolent demonstration. And if you don't think that you can cooperate or go along with the rules of the game, then don't participate. So we knew what was, so we were told to focus and don't make eye contact, and we walked in those lines and walked into F.W. Woolworth knowing the possibility, but it didn't happen. And it didn't happen. Violence did not occur. The only thing that someone spat on Clarence Fort. And Carmen says she remembers a man standing close by with a stick in his hand, and he kept hitting his
tapping
in his other
the stick
hand.
In his other
yes.
hand. Yeah,
but
that sounded threatening.
Yes. So, but we had endured segregation all our lives. This was the order of the day. Consequently, we were inspired by what had happened in North Carolina and Clarence's leadership.
Passion, his leadership.
And, yes, it was wonderful. So we just said, hey, it's our time now.
And how many of you were there at this first sit-in?
Oh, there were 20 from Middleton and 20 from Blake.
Oh.
Oh, yes. they were successful in getting the students. And so some of whom are very active now, Senator Jimmy Hargret, Wilbert Mathis, Leroy Long, Inez Anderson, you know, my classmates that I call on all the time. And so we just did what we had to do because we wanted to be treated like everybody else. We wanted to be able to go in Woolworth and sit down and eat. We could shop in there and buy things, but we were not served, could not get service at the lunch counter. And
they'd take your money as a customer, but they wouldn't serve you at the lunch counter.
No, they wouldn't. And Clarence Ford was, I mean, he stood up and said, this we're going to do. And Reverend Lowry was the state NAACP president at that time. And Bob Saunders was the state field director. Well, initially...
These are all names that people in Tampa would recognize from various important places. They've been honored with, you know, naming rights to things like George Edcombe Courthouse and the Robert Saunders Library. And, you know, these are people who are really deeply embedded in not only in the history of Tampa, but now contemporary history. People may not know why the library is named for Robert Saunders or why the courthouse is named for George Edcombe. So this helps explain that, right?
Yes, it does. And I was honored by the county commission because they named the library after me, the one near the University of South Florida.
There you go.
And so we just did what had to be done then. And we put fear aside because there are things bigger than fear. And it was the right to be treated with the dignity and respect that one gives to every other American. And black people were no exception. And consequently, we said, hey, you're going to do this. And we went headstrong. We were focused. We followed the rules, and ironically, there was no violence because Mayor Julian Lane had the police chief to bring his officers there to protect us. And we believe that Tampa was the first place and one of the few
unique
places that had the protection of law enforcement as opposed to them
attacking
us.
The demonstrators. Yeah. You know, Jim Davis, in 1960, Tampa benefited probably from having the first Southern governor to denounce segregation and the first mayor to, as Arthenia mentioned, to help integrate the lunch counters and also to have black and white community leaders who helped keep the peace. And your grandfather, Cody Fowler, was one of those city leaders. What did you hear from your grandfather about that or from your other family members who knew about his influence on these events?
Well, I knew the story as the young man, but not nearly with the punch that Mark delivered when he captured the story and the play was produced. My grandfather believed, as Julian Lane and Governor Collins and all of us, and I think most folks believe, we're all God's children, black, white, or brown. Julian Lane had been in an integrated army unit in World War II. My grandfather the same in World War I. And the way this story's been described, it was this way by a lawyer in Nashville who saw the play in D.C. This were the right people in the right place at the right time to do the right thing. Clarence Ford started it. These folks treated each other with respect. They looked past outward appearances. This was an example of people of character and faith, encouraging conviction, standing up for what they believed in. And as a result of that moment in our history, it's a proud moment in our history in both the black and white community. We successfully integrated our movie theaters, beaches, pools, and much of the city. Now, it's important to point out that Governor Collins and Mary Lane would go on to lose their reelection. But how this happened, as Arthenia alluded to, I think is a very important part of the story about, again, how do people work together in turbulent times based on shared values?
Let me take a moment to just do a station ID here. You are listening to WMNF at 88.5 FM, and this is Midpoint with Shelley Rebeck, and we are talking today about the play When the Righteous Triumph, written by playwright Mark Lieb, who's here with us in the studio, along with Arthenia Joyner, who was one of the student activists who brought desegregation to downtown Tampa in February of 1960. Hey, if you have some family history that you'd like to share with us about those times, give us a call at 813-239-9663. We'd love to hear from you about that. And I want to go back to Mark for a minute and ask, as a playwright, how did you decide how to focus the attention on this particular event? You know, there are many ways to tell a story, and you chose to make it all about the lunch counter sit-in itself. But there were a number of other characters that you brought into the play that were important to these events, like, for example, Reverend Leon Lowery. And I wondered how you came to decide, you know, where to emphasize, who to emphasize in the course of telling this story.
Yes, it was a challenging play to structure because first Clarence Fort was very important in getting the sit-ins going. Then Reverend Lowery was very important in allowing the NAACP in Florida to take over the sit-ins. Then Julian Lane, the mayor of Tampa, got involved, talked to Neil Brown, the head of the police. Then Cody Fowler got involved. By the time this thing was finished, it involved, in reality, dozens and dozens of people. And, of course, you can't hire dozens and dozens of people to make a play in a 99-seat theater in the Channelside District.
Right.
So I had to collapse a lot of these people into one. Reverend Lowery had colleagues who worked with him on the sit-ins. I had to basically drop them from the play and just focus on Reverend Lowery. There were 40 students involved, as Arthenia said, in the original sit-ins. I had to reduce that to two people that we could watch on the luncheonette counter and then assume that there were others. So there was a lot of change made for the sake of the theater. And someone asked me at one point, who's the main character? And I said, the main character is the request, may I have a cup of coffee? We're going to watch that character change over 2 hours from the answer being no in this first scene to the answer being yes at the end.
Interesting. I have a call here from Chris Fish in Tampa, and I'm going to bring Chris into the conversation. Okay, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Chris Fish, and I wanted to just thank everyone who made this play possible. I saw maybe the last performance at the Straz, and it was phenomenal, and I've never been prouder to be a Tampa origin person, and what an incredible thing. So congrats to everyone. And I wanted to briefly mention, I'm sure there's many efforts now kind of working for justice in this area and this spirit, but there's one in St. Pete called The Third Place, Rekindling the Space Between Us, and it's an organization that meets monthly, and it gets people together to debate topics in a nonviolent way and appreciate the value of diverse perspectives. And I went to one of their events, and of course, there's some self-selection. The people who show up to an event like that are people who are trying to be open-minded, but it had an experiential aspect, and I encourage all the many efforts that WMNF community is supporting to not only honor the history, but bring it alive. And I thought this organization, The Third Place, is really a cool one that had the same spirit as this phenomenal play.
That's interesting, Chris. If people wanted to know more about that organization, how would they find it?
I mean, you can look on The Third Place. There's a publication called the St. Pete Catalyst that has a article about it. You know, you can go to thethirdplacellc.com. The two women who kind of conceived of it felt that they wanted to actively, I don't want to say create a positive version of a lunch counter, but they wanted to have, like, people together There's food, there's drink, and like they start with lowball topics like what are better, having pets or not having pets, or having a dog versus having a cat. So things that like you could appreciate diverse views on in a non-threatening way. And then they build up to bigger topics like how to do economic development and things.
Thank you.
I don't want to distract from the play, but I just
okay
thank you for making that play, and it was phenomenal. Best thing I've ever seen at the Stress.
Thank you very much for calling in, and thanks for giving us that information about the third place. I have an email here, too, that I'm going to read. This is a story that all Tampanians should know. I first learned about it from the Tampa Technique documentary. Yeah, we should mention that there's recently been a documentary created by WEDU, the PBS station in Tampa. And I think you, Mark, and you, Arthenia, participated in that documentary, didn't you?
Yes, we're interviewed.
Yes. Yes, so that documentary is available, and you can see it on the PBS app or on the PBS channel if you're a member, or PBS through Amazon Prime. I think you can watch it on demand, and it's about the making of the play, right?
Yes, and I think you can get it just by going to WEDU.com, and there's a link.
Okay.
And it's being shown all over the nation in about 73 different cities. I've gotten feedback from friends, California and New York. In fact, one this morning from Houston, Texas, telling me they saw the documentary.
Yes,
on
it's
PBS.
Being shown on all the PBS stations around the country. So if you're interested in this aspect of Tampa history, we encourage you to check out that documentary. And is it called Tampa Technique?
Or no, it's called Triumph.
It's called Triumph. Okay, so if you Google it, you can find it, Triumph, from WEDU in Tampa on PBS. Okay, to continue with this email, she says, upon visiting the historical marker outside of the former Woolworth store in downtown Tampa, I learned that many people I was raised with were part of this brave group of teenagers. My mother, Jacqueline McKinney Preston, neighbor Arnold DuBose, former seventh grade civics teacher, Hildreth Fleming, and my cousin, Clarence Ford. I was shocked to learn from a marker that these folks are living Black history. Via the play at the Straz, I learned more about Tampa figures who I knew in name only. Mayor Lane, Attorney Cody Fowler, Reverend Lowry. Thank you to the producer and playwright, Mark, and the fundraiser, former Representative Davis, for their efforts. I took my 15-year-old son to the viewing at the Tampa Theater. I wanted to impress upon him the power that he has as a teenager, and also to let him know about the brave Black civil rights leaders that he is now growing up with. And she thanks us on Midpoint for airing this story. And this is from Natalie in Brandon.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. I know Jackie McKinney and her daughter. So to have a grandson to be able to see the play and know that she was an active participant is wonderful.
Yeah, to know that about your family history. I mean, of course, people without family history in these events, it's just as important for them to know. And as Natalie points out, for all Tampanians to know this history and to be, I think, kind of proud of the way that Tampa handled this situation, back in 1960 without violence, and the way that Jim Davis talked about people came together to collaborate for social change as opposed to fight social change. That's so significant now, given our current history and what we're seeing in places like Minneapolis, for example. You know, we're learning about the power of communities coming together. And I think that that's, you know, one of the most important lessons that we can learn from this play and from the Tampa Technique is the power of community, really. And of course, here at WMNF, we are all about community. Let me ask all of you, what do you hope that today's society can take away after hearing stories from the 1960s, stories like the lunch counters integration? And how can the lessons of the Tampa sit-in inspire more positive change today?
Well, it's been 66 years. It will be on the 28th of...
29th, yeah.
Yeah, the 28th this month.
Yeah.
And history has recorded this as an event that occurred that changed the trajectory of the city of Tampa. Consequently, the lesson to be learned is that events like this do start, as we spoke before, at the local level, and then they grow into a national, because the initial Greensboro sit-ins started, and then later came Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson and others. So it's local to me, that where everything, this is where the rubber meets the road at the local level. And it is important that all of the people in this community know the history of Tampa, and the young people, so that they will know what efforts were made to make this a better place for Black people and all marginalized folks in this community.
Well, it's not just for Black people, although it certainly is, but, you know, any community that is divisive and, you know, has problems between community members is not a healthy community. So it's Black people and white people together can benefit from learning this history, learning the Tampa technique, learning about the power of collaboration. At least that's what I think.
I agree. It's just that it emanated from the fact that Black people were being discriminated against. And so that is what brought it to the forefront.
Yeah.
And now if we utilize the technique that developed then and collaborate, because it's always my thought that if we sit and talk to each other, then we begin to find out that we all want the same things in life.
Well, certainly, and we all want peace, right?
That's right.
You know, and justice, I would hope.
But you know? This was only 66 years ago. That's not such a long time ago. Only many people are alive today who were young adults at the time.
Yeah, we have one in our studio right now.
That means that only 66 years ago, the Ku Klux Klan was active in Tampa. The White Citizens Councils were active in Tampa. We're going through a time now governmentally where there's been a lot of regression in civil rights activism and opposition to that activism. And I think it's important that people understand that racism is not dead, and that it was not a very long time ago that it was pretty virulent and savage
and
in this
violent
community. And
yeah.
Violent, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, you make such a good point, Mark, because, you know, in light of this administration's efforts to eliminate DEI, for example, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and the history that it was founded on, the history that made it, that made DEI so important. Just last week, for example, we learned that a judge had ordered the Trump administration to restore plaques about Black history and slavery in a Philadelphia national park. It, you know, to talk about George Washington's owning people, owning slaves. You know, the Trump administration ordered that history to be removed, and just last week a judge ordered it to be put back. I mean, so these are not issues of, you're right, these are not issues of ancient history. This is going on as we sit here. And so I think it's important to keep telling these stories, these local stories, to younger generations, to tie them to the history, to make them understand that and relate what happened 66 years ago to what is happening today.
And, you know, another thing that moved me to write the play was so much of fiction about Tampa and about Florida in general is about how trivial, how wacky, how silly life in Florida
is. Yeah, Florida man.
And I find that really unacceptable. I know that people are living real lives here. They're involved in tragedies and comedies as important as anything Shakespeare ever wrote about. And I wanted to write a play that showed that Tampa and Florida had gravitas, that important things were happening here, that this wasn't just some silly northerner's idea of a beachcomber's paradise.
Yeah, I think that that's really, really important. I think that in 2026, we still need to be taught about the civil rights movement and what preceded it. And we need to be able to see today's history, what will soon be history, today's events, you know, through the lens of history. Just last week, ironically, also last week in Black History Month, we lost a titan of the civil rights movement, Jesse Jackson, who was one of the people who have been held up as one of the heroes of the civil rights movement. But I've been reading about the teaching of Black history to get ready for this this show, and I came upon Dr. Bettina Love, who's a well-known educator, author, and founder of the Abolitionist Teaching Network, and she suggested that teaching Black history through a focus on, like, the great men or the heroes of the movement is a mistake, and it's doing students a disservice, the students of history a disservice. She suggests, for example, that it wasn't Martin Luther King who himself made the civil rights progress. It was mutual aid and collective action by groups of regular people, like the garbage workers of Memphis, and like the Tampa High School students who engaged in civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience, and really moved the needle forward. In fact, she wants students of today to learn that it's community solidarity, mutual aid, and nonviolent civil disobedience that are active strategies that make change. And they're not just historical footnotes. What are your thoughts about that? Do you think that we are teaching Black history in a way that is, most useful to students 66 years later, for example, from the events of the lunch counter sit-ins in Tampa?
Well, we are teaching Black history in our schools.
That's right.
Period.
You're right, in Florida.
It's the responsibility of knowing Black history is left to those of us who know Black history, who've lived it. We also have a responsibility to stand up against the present administration, both nationally and locally, to make sure that we teach Black history. But in the meantime, she has a point, but what happens is that, as I previously stated, most movements start at the local level, and they grow and attract someone who has the gravitas, the charisma to bring together people across the nation. So Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson and others who became the focal leaders of the movement, who brought people together, because we had different demonstrations all over the nation, but someone galvanized it, and that was Martin, and then Jesse. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't necessarily agree totally with what she said, but I think what she said coupled with them equals this issue being in the forefront in this country. Mm-hmm. And so we have a responsibility locally to make sure that we educate our people about what happened, and that those of us who lived it need to have more conversations about it in churches and schools and organizations. And we need a collective we need to do more of that, because it's obvious that the white power structure, political power structure, does not want us to teach our history. And we are not going back. It is unacceptable. And our kids are going to know about it if we have to do like they did in Africa, the griots, you know, just come out and
person
have sessions.
Person to person and tell stories.
And have sessions.
Yeah. Now, you listen, in Florida, we have, over the course of the DeSantis administration and our Republican-controlled legislature and our Republican-controlled Department of Education, we have lost so much in the way of teaching Black history in our Florida public schools. It's been restricted. and it's been, mispresented, if that's a word. The DeSantis administration has urged the teaching of slavery as a positive thing for people who learned useful skills. I mean, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, one of the people who Florida residents know almost nothing about is a man named Harry T. Moore, who is considered the first martyr of the modern civil rights movement. Harry T. Moore was an NAACP figure living on the east coast of Florida, and he was registering lots and lots of African-American people to vote in Democratic primaries at a time when Democrats completely ruled the state and you couldn't get a Republican elected. Many black voters had been Republicans because Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, and Harry T. Moore knew that the only way to get black power in Florida was to register as Democrats. So he was involved in this in a big way, and on Christmas night, not Christmas Eve, but the next night, 1951, the Klan put a bomb under his house and killed him and his wife.
Yes.
The first great martyr of the civil rights movement, and most people in Florida don't even know that he existed.
Well, you know, we know about that because these events involving Harry T. Moore's martyrdom is one of the topics in the book, American Scare, Florida's Hidden Cold War on Black and Queer Lives by Robert Fiesler. And Bob Fiesler has been on my show last year, and I'm bringing him back on April 8th, and we are... WMNF is doing a Wavemakers Live event at the Commodore on April 8th. Tickets are going to be $10 in advance. We're going to bring Bob Fiesler back to talk about his book, American Scare, Florida's Hidden Cold War on Black and Queer Lives, which is about the Johns Committee in the Florida legislature that was Florida's own little McCarthy committee that was attacking black people, queer people, and those on the left, and trying to ruin their lives in the late 1950s through the 60s. So if you're interested in this history, I encourage you to tune in to Midpoint on April 8th and come to our event, our Wavemakers event on April 8th, and learn more about these kinds of events, because one of the themes of this book that Bob Fiesler talks about is how integrationists, people who favored desegregation, were targets of the Johns Committee in Florida, and black and white people. And so it's a very interesting and, like you pointed out, Mark, very little known part of Florida's history. So we'll be dealing with that, as I said, on April 8th. Okay, one of the questions I had is, who coined the term Tampa Technique? How did that come to pass? Let me ask you, Mark, and you, Jim Davis, on the phone. Do we know where did that come from?
I'm not sure we know. It might have been Julian Lane, and it might have happened after the sit-ins. I couldn't specify. I learned about it as part of the sit-ins. Maybe Jim knows something about it.
Jim, do you have any insight on that?
If you watch the documentary Triumph on the WEDU website, we had a chapter in our history after the sit-ins where we had violence, and it came to a stop very quickly because, and I'm not going to tell the story, people need to go watch it. Folks worked together as they did with the lunchroom counters, and somebody came up with the term Tampa Technique, which also describes what happened in lunchroom counters. So I just want to put this in further context.
Yes.
As E.J. Salasinas, as part of our group, said, in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, Tampa was a little Ellis Island because the Cuban community and other nationalities had come to Tampa, the cigar industry and others. We had already gotten used to living together and being together, notwithstanding our origins or our superficial differences. We were still a southern city. In the play, there is a scene, which is true, where the Klan tried to kill Reverend Lowry. So the violence was outside the door. But Tampa is unique, but we reflected then where the country is today. We are a diverse country. That is not a bad word. And we're trying to sort of reclaim our history, which is we can work together and we should work together. And this wonderful story is an example that we need to hold up to the rest of the country now about how we come back together.
Yeah, that it's true that several years later, there was more upheaval in Tampa in terms of race relations. And so you wonder, is the Tampa technique something that is lasting? Is it something that, our local leaders can draw off in other contexts? I just wonder about that.
Years ago, I was an intern on the Tampa Times newspaper. This is in 1973. And, I was asked to write a piece about the fire department in Tampa, and I discovered that it's been a long time, but I think 600, it was either 300 or 600 firefighters, only three were black. And the Tampa technique is a wonderful thing, but I don't think we can sit back and say, well, Tampa is not a racist society, everything's going to be fine. I think we have to look for racism and other forms of discrimination constantly. And although, as Jim suggests, we can take great encouragement from the Tampa technique and from the nonviolence with which the lunch counters were desegregated, I think it would be wildly mistaken to think that we've solved the problem and we have nowhere to go.
Well, I have to say, sadly, that's all we have time for today, my friends. We've been very privileged to have with us some of the people who were involved with the important production of When the Righteous Triumph, the stage play, and now the making of documentary by WEDU-TV in Tampa. You can watch the PBS documentary for free through the PBS video app, on the PBS website, via the PBS channel on Prime Video, or on WEDU, I believe. My deep thanks to Arthenia Joyner, who got out of a sick bed to be with us today. We are very grateful for your participation, and to Mark Lieb, the playwright of When the Righteous Triumph, and to Jim Davis for calling in to give us his perspective on the Tampa technique. And we extend our great thanks to all of you. We will be continuing our discussion of black and queer history, as I said, at a Wavemakers Live event on April 8th at the Commodore. And you'll be able to get tickets for that a little later today or tomorrow on the WMNF website on our events page. And I would encourage you to come. It's a benefit for WMNF, and Bob Fiesler's a very engaging speaker. So I hope you'll attend to learn more about this important Florida history. Again, I really want to thank all of you who showed your support for Midpoint in the pledge drive, and remind you that if you haven't had a chance to renew your WMNF membership, you can still do so at WMNF.org and direct your contribution to MPW for Midpoint Wednesday. I want to ask you to pay attention to what is happening in the state legislature. We have two more weeks about of the session. There are some very important bills that are still pending. I told you about one of them, and that is House Bill 945, sponsored by Representative Danny Alvarez of Riverview, and Senate Bill 1712, sponsored by Senator Jonathan Martin of Fort Myers. If you care about those issues, if you care about freedom of speech and the First Amendment and not being arrested for your opinions, I think you should contact your legislators and let them know. All right. Now, please stay tuned for Talking Animals with Duncan after the NPR News. We are Midpoint on WMNF Tampa.